political commentator and investigative journalist. You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program. You're listening and watching TNT, today's News Talk, live and direct for the next 2 hours. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to everybody in the TNT chat room. Great to see you guys here. Got another powerful program lined up for you today. Yesterday was something else with Larry Johnson and Freddie Ponton back to back. Today, we're going to go to Europe. Actually, we're going to talk to a European correspondent on the ground in Spain, in Barcelona. The student protests in support of the Palestinian issue, they've spread to Europe and in a big way. We're going to talk to international journalist Yara Madureli here in the first hour. We'll connect her very shortly. Looking forward to that. She's been on the ground at universities in Spain, and she's going to give us her firsthand account and also how this issue is actually getting traction in terms of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Success stories on that front. Well, depending on who you're talking to, I'm sure the U.S. and Israel don't think it's a success. They're horrified by the fact that major institutions are withdrawing their investments relating to Israel. Now, we're also be joined in the second hour by Basil Valentine, the political editor here at TNT, who's been watching and trailing Xi Jinping and how this is interfacing with politics in the UK. Basil knows better than anybody how British politics works behind the scenes. We'll talk to him in the second hour. And also in the second hour, we'll also be connecting, hopefully, with a very special guest who is in the Far East. So we got a little bit of a time difference here. He's past the almost past the international dateline. Ryan Dawson, political commentator, is going to talk to us about not only these student protests in America. Ryan's been watching this from the beginning very closely, but also this faux anti-Semitism crisis. Ryan's very well placed to give us an honest appraisal of how this is all shaping up. I look forward to that in the second hour. So you do want to tune in with Ryan Dawson. That's going to be an interesting segment, to say the least. Now, a couple of disturbing developments on the international story docket here. The Polish leader, he is Donald Tusk. I don't know what to say about these guys. I often scratch my head. Prime Minister did an interview. I mean, this is like, we see a lot of this these days. We have major politicians, heads of state, doing interviews with children. I know it does sound strange and a bit creepy, actually. Donald Tusk did an interview with a 10-year-old girl. Don't ask me why. Anyway, he just did it. But he is something about the truth serum. These people can't hold back their honesty. He admitted Polish troops are on the ground in Ukraine. Donald Tusk, well done to break that news to a 10-year-old. I guess he thought it was safe to do it then. Anyway, Donald Tusk has kind of given the game away at a time when, as you tuned in yesterday with Larry Johnson, nuclear tensions are now escalating in Europe as a result of European leaders threatening and talking and admitting they've got boots on the ground in Ukraine and that they're willing to use longer range, intermediate range missiles, cruise missiles to hit targets deep inside Russia, as did David Cameron. So now you've got Tusk admitting this. This doesn't really help the NATO case. What you have here is quite simple. You have a confab, an organization called NATO that's comprised of various member states, but each of them have their own governments in the member states. So they have their own political leadership, and they are prone to gaffes all over the place. Not only that, they have one of the strangest and most awkward secretary generals you can imagine, a banker by the name of Jan Stoltenberg from Norway. And Stoltenberg usually puts his foot in it on a regular basis. He's very uncomfortable in the chair and often stutters to camera, doesn't quite know what he's saying and why. So this doesn't really inspire a lot of confidence in the whole NATO concept. And now you have individual NATO members provoking Russia. So who's in charge? That's the question. Is the U.S. in charge? Certainly Biden's not in charge. He doesn't engage at all with any of these other European leaders. Hardly do we see a reaction between Joe Biden, the White House, and what the various European NATO members are saying. That wasn't the case when Trump was president. He was more active in terms of NATO, provoking NATO, in fact, and threatening to withdraw funding, talking about the potential irrelevancy of the organization. A lot of people agree with all those points. But here we are now at the precipice of a potential nuclear escalation with Russia, and we've got major European countries here. In fact, one of them bordering on Ukraine, admitting that they've got troops on the ground in Ukraine. Now, we've been reporting about NATO troops on the ground almost since the beginning of the conflict, and there have been at the officer level, the so-called advisors, but the advisors are troops. The advisors are military personnel, whether they're working the ATACMS, the HIMARS, helping retrofit MiGs to have Storm Shadow and Scalp cruise missiles and so forth. So there are boots on the ground. There have been from the beginning, and many of them. The question is, at what point does it become a real problem? And I'll tell you when that becomes a real problem. Becomes a real problem when these officers are playing a part in hitting targets inside Russian territory or hitting Russian military assets in Crimea and so forth. Then it becomes a huge problem, because at some point these escalations can't go on forever. Russia's basically called the bluff of NATO, and that's happened this week. If you look at the statements by the Russian foreign ministry, their spokesperson Maria Zakharova, she's been very clear, and she kind of laid out a pretty disturbing statement. If you're in the West, Russia's ready to rumble. Is the West ready, though? That's the question. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova said that Russia may strike Britain's military facilities if their threats materialize. So a little bit disturbing, of course. She's really reacting to the untoward comments by Lord Cameron, David Cameron, the British Foreign Secretary, who's not in the House of Commons, bizarrely. He doesn't sit in Commons, doesn't take any questions. He's in the House of Lords. He was appointed, you could say. But anyway, they're saying that potentially legitimate targets, British targets, if Kiev uses British weapons for strikes inside Russian territory. Totally insane. Of course, but that's where we're at. So where is this all coming from? Why the provocations? What is the end game? We talked to Larry Johnson yesterday about this, military analyst, former CIA operative, counterterrorism expert. We talked to him, said, what is going on? Why the provocations? What do they hope to achieve? Do they want escalation with Russia? Is this what they're after? Do they want to ratchet up the tensions? Do they want to see major exchanges? Do they want to see tactical nukes deployed in order to justify a bigger military position in Europe? Is this what NATO really wants? All the indicators are that that's exactly what they want. The question is, are they prepared to deal with the fallout of those decisions that they're taking now to escalate? And I would venture to say that the people in European countries that are on the front line, who, let's face it, have the most to lose when it comes to an escalation like this, I'm including the Baltic states in this, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, all of the Eastern Europe, Balkan states, Serbia as well, Romania. I mean, they stand to have the most to lose. Does Washington care, though? That's the question. They don't seem to be too concerned with it all. That makes things all the more worrying. So this is why we're raising this issue now. It's why a lot of people are sort of raising the alarms now, saying, what on earth is going on? Are there any more adults in the room in the West, in any of these NATO states? Who's in charge? It's not Biden. It's definitely not Jan Stoltenberg. It's definitely not Olaf Scholz. And it surely isn't Ursula von der Leyen. So in the West, who is in charge? And if the answer is no one's in charge, you have to be extremely worried right about now. That's where our position is on this. And I don't really know what to expect going forward in the next couple of weeks. We do know it's an election year in the U.S. Both Trump and Biden would like to kick this can right down the road into January. Trust me on that. They don't want to see any kind of resolution on this, no negotiated settlement, nothing before November. nothing before November. Then someone will want to take credit for some kind of a development after the election, So we'll see. Biden could get an advantage by advancing the negotiations for peace in Ukraine before the election, or he could get attacked by the hawks and be shown as someone who's weak with Russia. And then they would be all over him in the press and media. You could be sure about that. So he's going to stay the course, status quo, until after the election. That's what it looks like from our vantage point, folks. But we could be wrong. If we are, put it in the TNT chat community right down there in the red bubble, lower right-hand corner, tntradio.live. That's where all the best people in our listener and support audience are during the program. That's where you want to be as well. Let's take a break right now with TNT Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We'll be right back.
TNT's State of the Nation.
How are Mr. and Mrs. Kelly right now?
Well, they're overjoyed. I will tell you, you know, they're exhausted. They're just, can you just imagine, right? They're exhausted. Let me start out by first of all, you know, thanking TNT, because you provided a critical platform for us to be able to get Mr. Kelly's story out there. And with your vast, viewer and listenership, it really helps. So I think you all need to pat yourselves on the back, just part of the team of truth, as I say it, the truth tellers, that managed to put significant pressure on the county prosecutor, George Silva and Kimberly Hunley and Michael Jetty, to, you know, close up this case.
State of the Nation on Today's News Talk, TNT.
The Lights is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
It's time to switch on
Today's News Talk Radio.
Very entertaining.
Yeah! TNT.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back to this live broadcast. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host, live and direct for the next 2 hours. Now, earlier in the week, we've been covering the student protests, the pro-Palestinian student protests right across the United States. A huge uproar, a major reaction from the political establishment, going so far as to wanting to ram a bill through the House of Representatives to throttle their First Amendment free speech under the guise of fighting anti-Semitism, plus huge police incursions onto campuses. We just saw the latest tally from New York. It cost $150 million. The city of New York had to fork out to turf these peaceful protesting students off of the campus of Columbia University and other sites around the city. Is it all worth it? What is the end game? Well, the big question is the reaction by the establishment, is this going to quell these protests in support of the Palestinian people, or is it making it go even higher? Is it making the movement expand? That's the big question. And it looks as if it is the latter. Over to Europe, we're seeing protests at European universities, and also some universities are now have announced that they're going to abide by the students' requests and demands and engage in BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions of the State of Israel. To talk more about this, I want to bring on to the program international journalist who is on the ground right now in Spain, in Barcelona. Iyara Mardarelli is joining us on the live link. Iyara, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for joining us. So it looks like from your reports, Iyara, that we've seen you posted on social media as well, it looks like this movement is going strong in Europe right now. Tell us what's happening in your part of the continent.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is obviously a chain reaction that started in the US, and Europe has now followed suit. Massive encampments everywhere. But in terms of Barcelona, yesterday, I was at the University of Barcelona hours after it passed a motion to effectively cut all ties with Israel It came days after Barcelona erected its own encampment here at the university, and their demands were met quite rapidly after, as you said, boycott, divestment, sanctions. In terms of the atmosphere itself, it was a pretty packed protest. There were hundreds of people. Spain overwhelmingly shows out in support of Palestine every single time. Hundreds of students and citizens, even students from Berkeley in the US, were present and celebrating the historic victory, you could call it. And of course, at the same time, continuing to call for a halt to this ongoing slaughter in Gaza. Zero police intervention. I mean, I've been to dozens of protests here. They're regularly peaceful here in Spain specifically. The people overwhelmingly stand with Palestine, and the other universities in Spain that have also followed suit was the University of the Basque Country, which actually cut ties with Israel back in April. There's another encampment right now at the University of Valencia. That one's been up for a week. And I mean, important to note here in terms of police intervention that there is none, because on March 22nd, Spain actually agreed to take the first steps towards recognizing Palestinian statehoods. So as a response to all of this, the Confederation of Spanish Universities announced just today, a couple of hours ago, that it's going to cut ties with any Israeli universities and research centers that haven't, in fact, expressed a firm commitment to peace and compliance with international humanitarian law. So that's what's happening here in Spain, Barcelona specifically, Patrick.
So from the government, just where's the Spanish government on this issue, just in, you know, broadly? I know you have a few different political factions in your legislature there in parliament, but where is the Spanish government on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, Pedro Sanchez was in fact a couple of weeks ago almost ejected from parliament, I'm assuming because of his pro-Palestine stance. People aren't very happy with him. However, he is the one who started the motion to recognize his Palestinian statehood. And then, of course, we have Ion Belada, who is a very well-known politician out here, who's also consistently calling for and putting a lot of pressure on the government here. So I think that Spain, Ireland, and I believe Malta as well, are going to be some of the first countries in Europe to actually officially recognize the statehood.
That's interesting. So that goes to reason that the police aren't going to come down very hard, because it's going to be seen politically and publicly as not a very good move, bad optics for the state. That's a stark contrast, Yadar, from the United States and the political atmosphere, as you know, right now. So we have a clip actually from, I think, one of the protests there in Barcelona at the university that you attended. Let's go ahead and have a look at this. Go ahead and roll this clip. Well, they're doing the infamous chant there. This is that strikes fear into the into the minds, lives rent free into the minds of everybody at Fox News. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Apparently, this liberation chant has been translated as a genocidal threat to the existence of all Jews on the planet. That's how the US and the Western media are pushing that. So they banned that term. I even think ex-Twitter, Elon Musk, might have banned it, I think, months ago, saying that this was akin to rampant anti-Semitism and genocidal rhetoric or whatever. But not the case in Spain, is it?
No, and I mean, point to mention here, it's not anti-Semitic to protest the actions of a state that's committing genocide. And there's absolutely zero obligation to protect the feelings of people who support genocide, right? So we know that, especially at these protests, and this is something that mainstream media, of course, likes to leave out, a huge part of the people that are organizing these protests are actually Jewish anti-Zionist students. So, you know, this obviously doesn't fit their narrative. I did want to touch on police brutality, though, because, of course, here in Spain, it's not present, but it is present in a lot of countries in Europe, right? So while we have these peaceful protests here and maybe in Ireland as well, and these demands are being met, which is very much an anomaly, we know that in the American encampments, not only have they been met with extreme brutality by the police and punishments, and I believe around 3,000 almost students that have now been arrested or been punished by, you know, getting expelled from university, the university bodies refusing to let them graduate for protesting a genocide. I mean, it's ridiculous. So here in Europe, many students have actually also been met with the same police brutality. And I think that a lot of that has only served to strengthen the movement overall. But yesterday in Amsterdam, on the same day that the University of Barcelona and Trinity College in Dublin passed the motion to cut all ties with Israel, in Amsterdam, the Dutch riot police arrested over 100 students. They didn't just arrest them peacefully. They hit them over the head with batons. They smashed their camps at the encampment, and they violently dragged these students off campus. And there's a lot of footage to show this. And in Berlin, officers have been, of course, as we know, Germany is very much cracking down on protesters. Full riot gear police assaulting students, clearing these encampments where hundreds were protesting peacefully. The same in a different part of Germany, Leipzig. A bunch of students were met with brute force, arrested. And, of course, we have to remind people that Germany a couple of months ago banned pro-Palestine demonstrations completely, and they removed the right of free expression. So this is happening in Amsterdam, in Germany, in France. Police also forcefully removed around 20 to 30 students who ended up barricading themselves in the main hall at the Paris Institute of Political Studies, which was, I believe, the first university in Europe to set up an encampment. And they made another 100 arrests at Sorbonne University in Paris as well. So this is, you know, happening all across Europe. We've also seen the UK, SOAS University, London School of Economics, the University of London is out in full force, Cambridge and Oxford also out in full force, all demanding, you know, for universities to simply reverse their investments into companies that are connected with Israel. They want full disclosure of where their tuition funds are going, which I think everyone should be privy to. And they want full divestment from all arms manufacturing companies. I think these demands are simple. I think they're very sensible. And I think that, you know, this is not a reason to beat students up and drag them out of the encampments and brutalize them. But yet again, you know, a lot of countries in Europe are following the playbook of the US, which is to call students anti-Semitic, even if they're Jewish, which is ironic, and calling them, you know, these crimes hateful, when students are very much seen, just as in the US, sitting peacefully protesting, not causing any riot unless the police gets involved and they have to defend themselves. And I think that this is going to continue. This movement is just going to grow more and more as time goes by, and I'm all for it. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. And, you know, with some of the images we'll bring on screen, but just looking at a country like Spain, we're also seeing some similar student activism in Greece and some of these other countries traditionally have, a very strong sort of internationalist worldview in terms of student activism. But it is very interesting to see this happening. What's more interesting, though, Iyara, is the success stories. Trinity College in Dublin, it's a very prestigious university. They've announced that they're going to basically pull their Israeli investments. So they're going to start that process and that transparency that you're talking about, which is the full disclosure of, you know, where their investments are. They have these huge endowment funds, these universities, sometimes in the billions. And that's an investment pool that's designed to ensure the future of the university, no matter what the economic situation is in the country going forward, and allow them to, you know, build buildings and finance the expansion of their institutions. But there's a lot of corporate money. There's a lot of international investments tied into those portfolios. Israel and their defense sector specifically features in a lot of this. So while they're turning a good profit on this over the years, the students are saying, no, we can't do this in good conscience. We don't want to be associated with it. So that's interesting. So Trinity College in Dublin, I don't know if you've heard of any other success stories on the European front.
Aside from Spain, unfortunately not yet, but I believe there will be more in Spain. More different universities here, aside from the University of Barcelona and, of course, the University of the Basque Country. No other university has yet cut ties. I believe Valencia might be next. And then, of course, we have Dublin. So those are the only success stories in Europe as of now. But yeah, you're completely right. I think a lot of universities won't divest. Their endowments fund scholarships, right? They fund university construction. They fund a bunch of stuff. So if they divest from these companies, they're going to lose a lot of money. And I mean, we can see it with the Harvard numbers. Specifically, Harvard has $50 million U.S. dollars in endowments. So of course, they're not going to be willing to make
that. It's much more than that. It's in the billions.
They're not going to make any changes to their investment portfolios. And I think that protesters and students have the right to demand this transparency about where the funds are going, and of course demand divestment so that they're not complicit in a genocide, which they haven't agreed to. So we'll see what happens next. But I think this wave is just going to grow in Europe more and more.
Yes. And also just your comments on, you know, you've been following this issue for a while, not just since October 7th, of course. And I know you're an international journalist, very much interested in what's happening also in the Middle East. And, you know, are you surprised at the uptake on this issue, how quickly and how profoundly, you know, young Gen Z, current university students have picked this issue up? And what was your indication on the level of their awareness of the issue? Did they understand the background of the story of Palestine? How did you see that? Because I know that's something that's interesting to hear what your observations are there.
Oh, absolutely. I think we're in the age of information now. So everyone has this information at their fingertips on their phone, right? And that's what changed really, is that our generation and the generation below us is really privy to what's happening. They have educated themselves. And if you hear these students on interviews speak about the situation, they know what they're talking about. They know exactly what's going on in Palestine. Thanks to, of course, now they're trying to ban the social media platforms that are providing the education. But these students, especially the ones at these Ivy League institutions, how dumb are we to think that they would not be completely aware of what's happening? These students are very well educated on the topic. I mean, one thing that's really important to mention now, and I think that a reason why there's so much uproar in the past few weeks, is that this recent invasion of Rafah that we're talking about, that Israel has been bombing Rafah nonstop for weeks. They've been killing dozens of civilians in refugee camps on a daily basis and sealed Palestinians into a death camp, effectively. Now people are talking about this as the final solution for Palestine. There's no words to describe what's happening anymore. But what's important for people to understand is that this Rafah invasion was supposed to be a red line for Western leaders. The Camp David Accords that was signed in 1978 forbid Israel from controlling this frontier with Egypt. And the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt was guaranteed by the U.S. government. But Israel doesn't care, it never has. It's a rogue state, continues acting with complete impunity. And that's why the student movement is really taking, you know, really going across the globe and exploding right now. It's as a result of seeing how time after time, Western leaders that they voted for will continue allowing their little pet project to act with this complete impunity. And they're saying no, no more. And I think that this is a historic moment, and that these students are truly creating change when it comes to freedom for Palestine and recognizing Palestine as its own state eventually. So I think it's amazing what's happening right now. I'm really proud of Gen Z, and watching this all unfold has been, you know, people are risking their education, they're risking potentially their future, but they don't care, because at the end of the day, we cannot continue watching a genocide and not act. So this is truly, there's unparalleled to any other moment that I've seen in the past, that, well, in my whole life, actually. It's an exciting time.
Did you say Yara, that there were universities threatening to prevent students from graduating as a result of taking part in this? Just give us any more details on what happened there.
These are American universities, right? These are American universities that have threatened people with, you know, not graduating, or expelled them, or threatened them with expulsion. So students are risking potentially their entire future to protest and to stand with Palestine, and their understanding that this is more important. So this is huge. But yeah, the actions that have been taken aside from the arrests are expulsions and more, just punishments for standing against a genocide.
Yeah, and that's on top of getting maced and tear gassed and beaten by police and counter protesters, as they're called, pro-Israeli counter protesters, as we saw at UCLA, the harrowing scenes there. Pretty shocking stuff. I'm with Yara Madureli. She's an international journalist based in Spain, giving us a snapshot of what's happening on campuses in Europe as this pro-Palestinian student movement expands and goes global. And it's not just Europe and North America. We're also seeing demonstrations in South America, Australia, New Zealand, and even in Asia. So it's going to be very interesting. The more they try to put this down, the bigger it becomes. And isn't that always the way? Now, when we come back, I want to take a short break with the network, but Yara, I want to talk to you about this so-called anti-Semitism crisis. Is it a real crisis? What's behind it? What's fueling it? And how is this kind of self-contradictory on its face? And what are the effects that this is going to have on free speech, especially in Western democracies? We'll talk about that with our guest after the break. I'm Patrick Kenningson. You're listening and watching TNT, Today's News Talk. We'll be right back.
Right now, the forgotten poor are waiting for healing and care, for life-saving medical care, for a chance to live with dignity and hope. They are waiting for Mercy Ships and you. Mercy Ships is the largest floating civilian hospital in the world, with volunteer medical staff and crew who donate their time to save lives. And now, as our newest state-of-the-art hospital ship sets sail, Mercy Ships will double our ability to reach children and adults who need us now.
Without the work of Mercy Ships, these patients don't have another option.
Mercy Ships is answering the call to serve suffering people who have nowhere else to turn. Together, we are going to some of the world's most desperate places and bringing a wave of hope and healing to those who need it most.
Thank you!
Thank you!
To learn more about this wave of hope, go to mercyships.org today.
We are for pets. We do anything for them because they do everything for us. We are for people, for those who love pets unconditionally. We are for good, from adoptions and veterinary care to disaster relief and fighting pet hunger. We stand together to create a better world for pets and families in need. We are PetSmart Charities, for pets, for people, for good.
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back. Patrick Henningsen here, live and direct TNT Today's News Talk. I've got international journalist Iyada Madureli is joining us on the live link right now. Iyada, how are you? Thank you for joining us. And so we have this anti-Semitism crisis happening, supposedly this wave of righteous indignation about the spread of anti-Semitism on campuses. And they're kind of extrapolating this to be a whole sort of national crisis on its own. So what's your assessment of this? And, you know, we can kind of see how in a certain way this is a kind of farcical charge at this point. It's been so overused. But you have Arab students protesting. They're Semitic. The Palestinian students in the West, they're Semitic as well. So how could they be against themselves? But it kind of speaks to the fact that this word doesn't really mean anything. What exactly does it mean? Or maybe the power is in the fact that we don't know what it means. Go ahead.
The word has completely lost its meaning. I mean, I think it's just interesting how the pro-Israeli lobby seeks to consistently dismiss this criticism of an outright genocide as anti-Semitism. It's not. It's never going to be anti-Semitic to protest against the deaths of children and women and just civilians throughout. We should be protesting this extremist political leadership in Israel. We should be protesting the fact that, you know, I just don't understand how we can continue to peddle this lie of anti-Semitism. And as you said, the word has completely lost its meaning, especially when there are so many Jewish anti-Zionists that are out on the streets all across the world protesting this. So it's just a spin that the mainstream media is going to continuously use. And as long as their narrative is not covered, This is going to continue. So I think that when it comes to anti-Semitism, I don't take it seriously anymore. Whoever, you know, it's just as much as every protester that's pro-Palestine has to be a terrorist supporter and an extension of Hamas, essentially. It's just outrageous. It's outlandish. And at this point, I think that the whole world realizes it and nobody takes this seriously anymore. So there's no point in even considering this as an actual smear, because to everyone in the world, this word has just completely lost its meaning. So I don't think that the word anti-Semitism can really be used anymore to describe anything, because it's covering just such a broad sector of people that are all out in the streets protesting deaths of children. That's not anti-Semitic. It never will be. And also, like I said earlier, we are under no obligation to protect the feelings of people while there's an active genocide taking place.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, I remember it wasn't so long ago, there was a big uproar on campuses about safe spaces for, you know, gender neutral or trans students or whatever. There was a bit of this during the sort of BLM protests as well. And that got a lot of media attention at the time, but they were just talking about spaces, not the entire campus and not the entire city. So, I mean, this is like, kind of snowflake woke right. We'll call it the woke right, as they call it, the woke right. It's on steroids. So not only that, as I've said before, they want the safe space to be between your ears. So they want to be able to control what you're saying and thinking, backed up by legislation. I mean, it seems like the lobby here is really overplaying their hand to the point where this term will just be rendered useless at some point. For young people, do they regard this with the sort of, do they shriek in fear when this charge is leveled at them? I mean, what do you think?
No, not at all. They at this point, they laugh at it. It's just unserious. There's nothing serious about calling someone anti-Semitic anymore. Germany, with its all its Holocaust guilt, now trying to peddle this anti-Semitism. Germany is one of the countries in Europe that has, of course, done this the most. Just people look at this as outrageous, ridiculous attempt at a smear. That's just not going to work anymore. I think the whole world, I think you mentioned the word would be rendered kind of pointless in the future. I think it already has. I think the whole world doesn't take that word seriously anymore, because just as much as everyone is Hamas, everyone is anti-Semitic, all because we stand against a genocide. No, it's that's just not going to work anymore. Those mainstream media narratives are just not going to work anymore. We've already surpassed that, and we're in a completely different ballpark now. So now all that matters is to effectively end this genocide in Palestine. And until it is not ended, people will not leave the streets. They will continue protesting every single day until Palestine is free.
Yeah, this is look, the more you sort of try to shut down these sort of things, it just becomes bigger and stronger. Not only that, it kind of validates the reaction. Don't you think that the reaction from the establishment, from the police, from some of these university administrators that want to shut these protests down, it's almost validating and kind of giving street cred to the protests. So younger people are looking at this, you know, they want to be part of maybe something that's a little more challenging to the establishment. And this is ticking all the boxes right now, Iyadar. So it's like the harder they try to shut it down, the more legitimacy it gets and the more it spreads. I mean, I was talking to some students earlier in the week, and they have like they subscribe to WhatsApp groups in their regional area. And they just say there's like dozens and dozens of meetups, rallies and groups right across the entire region. So it's like it's incredible. So that means that you're seeing a proliferation of this at a time when it really wasn't natural that this issue would ever sort of get the kind of global traction that it has. And then just the proliferation of groups and activist groups and rallies right across the world, across continents and countries. It's just something that was really unexpected. I certainly couldn't have seen this happen, nor could anybody envision it to be as comprehensive as it has been over the course of the last 6 months. But let's not forget, remember the scenes that we were covering back in January, back in December, in fact, when you had hundreds of thousands of people converging on the nation's capital in the United States in Washington, D.C. Some would say 500,000 person march, same in London. I mean, it was just shocking to see early on, just this last winter, the reaction, the response from people on this issue that shocked everybody. And just to see it sustain up to this point and become pretty much a broad-based anti-war movement that's gone right across the world is something that I just couldn't predict. So people are utilizing social media, Telegram and WhatsApp. There's hundreds of rallies, protest groups. If you're in Canada, if you're in Brazil, if you're in the United States, if you're in Europe. So it's absolutely incredible. So I just see this actually growing right now. So the longer there's no resolution to this on the ground in the Middle East, or the longer that Western governments are seen to be dragging their heels on it, the bigger this protest movement is going to become. What do you think?
Yeah, no, and I think that's kind of the moment that we've been waiting for, you know, your generation, my generation, for the longest time. I think it's phenomenal to see that the people are not backing down until their demands are met, until Palestine is free, and until the ceasefire happens. I think it's incredible to see that the Western governments are trying so hard to stop this movement, but it's you know, like a flame has been lit across the entire world. People have now seen what's truly happening, and they won't back down, especially because they've also realized how much Western governments work together with the mainstream media and together with each other to ensure this colonizing entity continues and remains alive. I think it's so clear as daylight, especially when you have Israel breaking every single international law, committing dozens of war crimes, and just continue with impunity while brazenly filming themselves, the soldiers filming themselves smiling and laughing as they're decimating and killing entire families with glee, almost. It's absolutely insane. to watch this happen. I think we've never seen such a clear display of an asymmetrical warfare as we do now. And I think that because it's so clear, because Israel has always been allowed to act with such impunity, it's just clear as day to everybody who the perpetrator here is and who needs to be stopped. And it's the PET project that has been placed there. In 1986, Joe Biden himself said that if there were no Israel, they'd have to create one to protect their interests in the Middle East. We know exactly what this is about. We know that this is about economic interests. We know that this is about oil. We know that what this is really about. So now the world that has been, once your eyes have been opened, you can't close them anymore. And that's where we're at right now.
Well, another interesting development, Yadar, is that Joe Biden has announced, or the White House announced, they're going to stop sending heavy weaponry to Israel while they're basically doing this incursion, this invasion of Rafah. There's a lot of kind of wishy-washy language mixed up in this. And my personal take after speaking to Larry Johnson yesterday is that he said that actually the reason they're announcing this publicly is because they've actually run out of ammunition between Ukraine and Israel. And to save face and to not look like complete buffoons on the world stage, they're saying, Biden's basically saying, well, we're going to restrict it because of the Rafah situation. But the embarrassing truth might be that the U.S. doesn't have any to give. I mean, that would be quite an extraordinary story. And it will come out if that's the case. It might not officially come out now, but eventually it will. So, I mean, so that's on that side, that's kind of interesting. So nonetheless, you get the result. It's going to create a backlash against Biden by the Israeli lobby. Trump's going to capitalize on it and say Biden's weak. He's not with Israel. He's not loyal to our best ally in the world. Therefore, I'm better and so forth. So that's how the political battle will shape up on that side. That's interesting. But like on the ground right now, I don't know if you're following the Rafah situation at the moment, but I mean, the footage that I've seen, I don't even want to, got plenty of clips I could show on the air, but they're too horrific, quite frankly. I've shared some of them on social media, some of them I can't share. But the scenes we're seeing, it's reminiscent, Yada, of, you know, November and December, when there's really heavy bombing in northern Gaza. So tell us your kind of view on how that situation is developing.
You know, I think it's worse than in November and October, because now these are people in refugee camps. They've been sent to Rafah, which is supposed to be a safe corridor. They've been sent there for safety. And despite this, they're bombing refugee camps. We're seeing it on a daily basis. There is no more, you know, we're trying our utmost to only target Hamas terrorists and whatever Israeli spokespeople want to say. There's no such excuse that can be used anymore when we've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of children dead on our screens. It's that this is unparalleled to anything we've seen in history. Not only are there already 35,000 dead Palestinians, the number will be much higher once the dust settles and once we find all the people under the rubble. They are not only also starving them, they are methodically bombing and executing people on a daily basis. There's no more hiding this. This is not only is all of this happening. They've destroyed the entire infrastructure in Gaza, made it unlivable. That was their goal, right? They've achieved it. They've achieved this goal. But now the fact that they're doing this, that they're invading Rafah, a zone which is supposed to be safe, there's no more. You can't get away from what they're doing anymore. This final solution that we're talking about, that people are mentioning about, especially at a time where they're breaking international law again with the David Accords that forbid them to do this. I mean, I have no more words. Like I said, I have no adjectives left to describe what we're seeing. I do think we're getting to a point where people are becoming more desensitized, But at the same time, I think that as these movements globally continue to grow, now also recently, as you've seen, Macklemore, the music industry, slowly starting to, you know, be a little bit more vocal about this, I think this is just going to be, like I said, a fire that's been lit that cannot go out anymore. But yeah, Patrick, it's horrific. New scenes every day that would give you nightmares.
Al-Shifa Hospital, another mass grave, discovered 49 people. A lot of the victims being tied and bound, they're finding as well. I mean, these sort of things normally would make major headlines. They'd be the subject of, you know, there'd be major emergency session at the UN Security Council condemning all of this stuff. But isn't it a case, Yadar, that there's so much? There's so much horror. There is so much devastation, so much killing at the hands of the Israeli so-called defense forces that it's just so hard to basically process. That our media is not equipped, the mainstream media anyway, and the institutions are not equipped to deal with this many war crimes, with this many crimes against humanity. Thus, it's becoming impossible to highlight some of these things, but any of these individual scenes or events would have dominated the news cycle, you know, a decade ago, two decades ago. It would have brought horror to the world. But here, nothing. I mean, what do you think, as a person who works in media? Go ahead.
Imagine that these scenes on our phones that we see every day are happening after they banned Al Jazeera, which is absolutely ridiculous, by the way. And after they've killed hundreds of journalists, we've never seen this in history. Not once in history have as many journalists been killed, marked clearly with press. And I mean, this precedes, as we know, October the 7th. So never before has this happened. I think it's the fact that we're seeing all these scenes on our screens after Al Jazeera was banned and after all these journalists were killed just tells you that there's so much, as you said, we can't even process the amount of horror coming out. But I think that Israel is, in a way, happy about the fact that they've desensitized a large part of the population, that now they can continue with their little invasion and their little colonizing project, because now people are maybe paying less attention. Well, not this generation and not the generation below. These people are paying attention every single day. Every single day, Palestine is in our thoughts. Every single day, we find ways to do whatever we can do to demand an end to this genocide, whether it be at protests or, you know, here speaking about it as you do every day brilliantly, or, you know, writing books or whatever it is that you can do, producing songs about this, right? Whatever it is, I think that people have really understood this now. They've understood that whatever my skill set is, however I can help to shed light to what's happening, even just to friends and family, whoever I can educate today is one more person, and one more person that's going to say, no, I no longer accept this reality, and we're shifting towards a completely new one now. So yeah, Patrick, those are my thoughts on that. I think the horror is just, sometimes you have to shut off and you have to kind of almost recalibrate in a way and continue fighting the good fight, right? Because this stuff, it's going to paralyze you seeing these scenes. And I think that in a way, that's something that Israel also aims to achieve, is this paralysis where people say, there's nothing I can do about this is way, but that's not true. There is something you can do. You can, there's so many things you can do. And if you don't know where to start, find a local community that is, on any social media now you have them, where you can find protests that they're holding or meetings or anything, right? Just a community, because a community in these times, and people that agree with you and people that are out there fighting alongside you, will keep that fire lit as well. So that's very important. Every time I go to a protest, that kind of fire and that urge to continue is just relit again. So I think that's a really important thing that people have to do if they haven't yet.
Yeah, and this is also about people just kind of being able to rally around some common issues that everybody can agree on, that everybody can say, you know, we think this is wrong. This is not acceptable. This is not what we're about. This is not what our country, our community, our generation are about. So from that point of view, it is good to see that this is taking shape globally right now. International journalist Yadier Mondarelli joining us from Barcelona, Spain. Thank you for that update. Thank you for your reports. And follow Yadier on X, Twitter. We'll drop her handle in the TNT chat community. She's doing great updates on this and other stories. Thank you very much for joining us this week. There you go. There she goes, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to go top of the hour news headlines right now. And on the other side, we'll connect with our TNT political editor, Basil Valentine, and a whole lot more. Stay with us.